Welcome to Dry Hard Pod, a podcast by two dry millennials learning to live their most authentic lives after booze.
Hi!
Hello, hello!
Oh, hello.
Okay, here we go. This week, we are welcoming a very special guest and friend, Amy Merrill. They are the executive director of the Cupcake Girls, a badass single and booze-free mom who currently lives in Las Vegas. Welcome, Amy.
Hello. Thanks for having me. It means a lot to me. A lot. And I'm so pumped about this project that you're doing. I think it's the answer to a lot of people's cries for community. So thank you so much for doing this.
Thank you so much for coming on. Background for some folks on how I know Amy. She was like one of my first friends when I moved up to Portland, and we would hang out and watch like crime shows all the time. And yeah, it's just like we go way back, but I haven't seen you in a while and gotten to talk to you, and so much has happened. And also it feels like just yesterday that we were hanging out. So yeah, just so excited to hear like where life's taken you and what you've been up to and your alcohol-free journey. So I think just to kick it off, like tell the audience a little bit about yourself and how long have you been alcohol-free?
Well, my name is Amy Marie Merrill. My pronouns are she, her. And I love long walks on the beach. I actually love being outside, and being outside is like such a huge just salve for my mental health. And I try to go outside at least 30 minutes a day. That's super amazing for me. And I have an 8-year-old just
turned
8.
Oh my God.
Yeah. Luxamora Merrill, who is my child after 2 miscarriages. And her name means light and love. And that's exactly what she is. She's always singing and dancing and just the best. She's always making me art, telling me about how cool she is.
She is one of the most confident children, you know, even when she was a toddler, just like so confident and sure of herself. And that's definitely due to like some strong, you know, female influence and representation in her life, which is just so cool to see.
I love it. We've worked really hard to make sure her dad and I, that as she's been raised, that she understands how cool she is and is able to embrace all of her power by not minimizing her beauty and minimizing her greatness and her intelligence. But yeah, just really encouraging it. And so that's great. And then I have a German Shepherd Boxer Mix rescue, Luna, who's fantastic, super cuddly. And I'm the executive director of the Cupcake Girls. I've been working with sex workers and sex trafficking survivors since 2006. Yeah, that's just kind of like a quick synopsis of me. How long I've been booze-free? I have been working on my sobriety since my grandma passed away in February 2020. Wow. That doesn't mean that I have had straight sobriety since 2020. There's been lots of bumps along the way, but it's been something that has been a goal of mine since then. And I have been experiencing straight sobriety for just over 12 months now, 12 months and 3 days. So it's pretty exciting.
Congrats. That is exciting.
That's so awesome. That, like, yeah, 1-year mark is huge.
Yeah. But it's been honestly one of the best gifts that I've given to myself. And definitely my daughter and family and close friends have been able to experience the beauty of sobriety. And it's been encouraging for me to just truly understand who I am outside of drinking. I think I was using it as medication, honestly, for a really long time. And, but we can get into all of that, but that's a little bit about me.
I love that. So Amy, will you kind of start from the beginning for us here? Like, when did you start to notice your relationship with alcohol? And what were you doing at that point in your life? What was going on?
Yeah. So from the start, honestly.
And do you remember, sorry to cut you off, but do you remember when you started drinking? Because I know for some folks, it's like not until they're 21. Some folks, it's a lot like even later. For Katie and I, it was, you know, in middle school.
It was early. Yeah.
Yeah, it was pretty early, all things considered. So,
yeah. So I come from a pretty tight-knit Italian family. And so my parents would let us like sip wine off the table and things like that. But I've always been quite the rule follower, and like things done a certain way. And so I did not drink until I left the house. So I started drinking around 18 because my parents didn't want me to drink and I wanted to follow their rules. And, but I went to be a flight attendant when I was 18 and really was introduced to alcohol when I was a flight attendant. I had been homeschooled my entire life and really didn't have a lot of socialization outside of my family and our local church that we went to. And I was really lonely. I was really, really lonely. I was on these planes with different crews and I was the youngest one on the planes. And so the crews would go out to the bars when we would have overnights and I didn't have anywhere to go. And so I would just kind of be in my hotel room. And then we had an overnight in Canada at one point. And since I was 18, I could drink. And went to this bar called the Foggy Dew, and I didn't know how to drink because I had no idea what I was doing. And so I kept ordering shots of Goldschlager and chasing them with Corona. And everyone was like, "This girl's so fun," and you know, and it was just so weird. And then I finished off the night with a white Russian, which is like everything is just like the weirdest combination.
Amy, I feel like you're describing Kaylee's situation with Goldschlager and mine with a white Russian on my 21st birthday. Like so not good, that combo.
It was like the worst, and I'll never forget. I was just telling my dad this story actually. I'm sitting at the table with this crew that's just this fight crew that's just thinking I'm the most hilarious person because it was like such a wild situation, and my cell phone starts to ring. And I had the like dun dun and dun dun phone ring for my dad because remember how super cool? It was super cool to pick phone rings for everybody. Yeah. So my phone starts going dun dun and dun dun, and I was like, oh, "It's my dad! Do you guys want to say hi to my dad?" And everyone's like, "No, no, don't pick up the phone." And that's when I realized, like, "Oh, this isn't good."
Yeah, I'm breaking
the rules.
Something's
weird here. And the entire flight crew went home and I ended up at the bartender's house that night playing Super Mario Kart with his girlfriend and him and then kind of rolling out of the hotel bed the next morning going like, oof. And that really started my relationship with alcohol as this like social salve where it was like, I don't really know how to fit in. I don't necessarily have all of the etiquette down and the ways to connect with folks in the outside world, but I know that I can drink with people and then they like me. And so, you know, there would always be somebody I could be going out with, I could be drinking with. And it was like, it was so terrible. It was bad for me. And it really changed my perspective on who I was too. Right. Cause I was just looking for acceptance. And I was finding it quickly. But then I went to Eugene and kind of was hanging out with my brothers and their friends, which is really how I got connected with you two.
Yeah.
There's a lot of like house parties and, house shows, which were so fun. And there's a lot of drinking. And then I went to work at, an advertising agency in Portland and there were kegs on every floor and, you know, it would be so cool to have like free cocktails all the time. And so this like social salve was just kind of always there, but I never really dealt with the heaviness that was also going along coinciding this introduction into society from truly being isolated, you know, as somebody who was raised a specific way in a more of a homeschooled situation. And it wasn't until honestly, like 2020 that I was just looking in the mirror one day and I was like, who do I want to be? Yeah. Is this the cycle that I want to see for myself? Is this a cycle that I want to see for my daughter? Because I'm just not happy with the woman that I'm seeing looking back at me right now. She just looks so sad. And I don't think that sobriety is the answer to happiness, but I do think that it's given me access to deep pain that needed to be looked at. And it needed to be discovered and talked through and just honestly recognized for what it was and having the ability to, instead of like pushing it down by continuing drinking and continuing on the path that I was, which was just like, all right, bottle wine a night. And that was just kind of my thing. It was like a bottle wine a night and Law and Order. And it wasn't a big thing. Like, moms drink wine at night. That's like a thing for moms. So it was just, I was able to go into these next rhythms from being, you know, this kid, mom. It was just so socially acceptable.
Mm-hmm.
But what wasn't socially acceptable was just the pain that was just never being dealt with. And and so it was interesting, like the sobriety piece was just it was a bigger piece of a wake up call for me of just saying like, hey, you know, you're okay. And you're going to be okay. And we're going to figure this out together. And we're going to figure out how to create rhythms of care for you so that you're not having to keep perpetuating these harmful rhythms in your life. And you can set up Lex for success, and you can set up your team for success and your friends for success. And it was so terrifying, honestly. And honestly, like I got made fun of a lot and pressured a lot. I mean, one of my previous bosses would literally, in front of all of the other employees at work events, would say, you're just not as much fun if you're not drinking.
Yeah, I received that a lot. That was a thing. It was like, well, you're supposed to be my good time pal. And I'm like, I am a good time, right? Because that was just reaffirming that belief that I'm not fun without alcohol.
100%. It honestly, like, it caused a lot of, well, first of all, it caused a wake up call for me that boss was a really unhealthy influence in my life and just an unhealthy person in general. But it was just such a interesting situation because those feelings of wanting to fit in, they became larger in those moments than the idea of healing for myself.
Mm.
And so like those moments, they did cause relapses, which were my choice. You know, nobody chose it for me.
Right.
But hearing like, no, you're just not as much fun. And me saying like, but I am fun. Like, I think I'm more fun when I'm not drinking. And hearing like, no, you're not. Or really, everyone else is drinking. How come you're not drinking? And those being like common occurrences, they are such harmful things to be saying to somebody else. And honestly, though, I am thankful for the opportunity for me to be like, why am I not drinking? You know, because every lapse that would happen, I would be like, but that's not what I want. I'm not doing this for her and I'm not doing this for anyone else. I'm doing this for me. And so it was helpful, but it was harmful, right?
Totally. Like most things are, like the things that we learn from are, they hurt and they're helpful. And we are given the opportunity to choose ourselves. It just takes practice and time. I mean, Kaylee and I both had tried and said, we're not drinking anymore. And then 3 days later, you know, whether it was a reward for ourselves or is peer pressure or just that feeling of inadequacy at the end of a hard day or just wanting to numb out, you know, there's so many, when there becomes so many reasons to drink, it gets more and more difficult to say no to.
Especially when everyone around you is doing it all of the time.
That's it.
So like, I can definitely relate to the agency life and the happy hours. And that's why community is so important in getting alcohol free, is because our entire community is just like, that's what you do.
Right.
And I was supposed to go to a party this past weekend and declined it because I was just like, it takes me so much now to like get in that mood to be social. Whereas before I could pregame and just, you know,
push through.
Yeah, it feels like this big secret that everyone has. Like, how many of those other people who are at that party drinking don't feel good about their relationship with alcohol, you know?
Well, and I think that is a part of this too, is that the majority of people who are doing that, you know, that normalizing that drinking and are participating in that environment are saying like, Amy, why aren't you drinking? They also are using your choice to drink or not to drink to determine whether or not they should be drinking.
Right.
And so it makes them feel like, you know, that they're required to reflect and to look at themselves. And I know that that's something we've talked about quite a bit on the podcast, and which is why I think that this ripple effect is so interesting, because how many more people do we know now, since we decided to question our relationship with alcohol, are also doing it? So it works both ways, which is really, really beautiful as well.
Well, what's fascinating is the same boss that was giving me such a hard time about alcohol forever, when it was time for them to really face like the amount of anxiety that they had in their bodies and things that were going on, they ended up coming back to me and saying, you know, why aren't you doing this? And it's been interesting because I end up just kind of like, I don't know if you've had these moments, but just kind of like smiling through a few things, because there's been a few times like they'll be on the news for being like sober and I'm like, oh gosh.
Oh my gosh. No.
It's and just like, but then I'm like, you know, is it more important that maybe somebody else is encouraged about alcohol free living, or is it important for me to get like an apology or like, yeah. And then it's just like, you know, Amy, just let it go, which slowly but surely forgiveness is more important than holding resentment, right? You can't go, hey, I don't know if you've ever had any experience with AA, but AA talks about just like really just forgiving people. And that's that letting go of the resentment and letting go of the harsh feelings that I'll have, it's so freeing for myself.
Yeah. You know?
More so than other people. But I do think it's important just to mention, because I think that a lot of folks that are fighting these lapses, they've been in similar situations to me, because I've heard these stories and they're just like, it's not fair. It's not fair. You know, where's the justice? And it's like, well, justice never comes. Like, it's not going to come. And I'm so sorry. This world's not fair. But how can we be just to ourselves? What choices can we make so that we can live a life that brings justice to our own bodies and our own spaces and our own communities? You know, so let's just not give, you know, 2 seconds to this other person and really start to think about what are ways that I can protect and curate spaces of resiliency in my life, that I'm not stumbling, you know? And then the conversation becomes different. It becomes about hope and healing rather than just gritting through the next frustration that you have with like that one person. Because a lot of us have had those situations, right? Like, I'm not alone in this. I think that we all can kind of think of that person in our lives. And
I actually have something to add here. This is interesting. I have the opposite dynamic. So as most of our listeners, no, my father has been alcohol-free for 12 years. Mm-hmm. And now I am. And he wants credit for my...
Give it to him.
I'm like...
Give him what he wants. I'm just kidding.
He does not want to hear the credit that I have for him and why. it's influenced not only my alcohol-free journey, but also my journey with alcohol, right? Because... Mm-hmm. It is all rooted in the same shit.
Yeah.
And so forgiveness, and he's an AA member, active AA member. And it's forgiveness is something that I've been working on, like with a mentor and in a coaching program, and it feels really good. And I was at a retreat this summer where I actually wrote him a forgiveness letter and read it out loud with this group. And it didn't sound like forgiveness. And I'm excited to keep writing the letter over and over again until maybe one day it does. But I have noticed that with each
attempt
at forgiveness, yeah, I am developing like a vast amount of compassion for him, which is so healing for me and in our current relationship. So yeah, I just thought that was an interesting aspect of that. Who wants credit for what?
That's really beautifully said. And I think that it's important to be said too. Thank you for your transparency and your willingness to be open about that, because, you know, maybe not verbally, but definitely in you choosing to be transparent about this, you're giving permission for people to do the same. Because I think a lot of us have a lot of roots, right? I mean, with stuff that happened to us. And honestly, my parents are like fantastic people. They really, really are. And they did the best they could with what they have. I have 5 younger brothers. I'm the oldest of 6 kids. And my mom had me when she was 24. And I'm 36 now. And I keep thinking, like, that woman had 5 kids at 36. she did a great job.
That is fucking wild.
She did a great job.
Oh, God.
I know. I just think about it all the time. I called my mom yesterday. I'm like, Lux wanted to talk to me about her feelings. This is what I said in return. What do you think? And then she told me, like, you did a great job or whatever. And I was like, you did this with six kids? Because everybody has different feelings and different, you know, ways to interact with the world or whatever. So anyway, I think it's, I mean, I know that everybody has different relationships and experiences with their parents, but I think it's really beautiful to be able to give constructive criticism to your experience while also understanding that that's your experience and it's yours to hold and to forgive and to do whatever it is and into the next stage. So it's really cool.
Thanks. Yeah. It's been a long road and it will be for a long time probably. So
it is interesting though. And I know Kaylee can remember this, but we would have like weekends and we'd be like, all right, so we're going to have bean dip and three bottles of wine and we're going to watch Law and Order and that's going to be our thing. And then when you have those like rhythms stop, right? When you're like, a lot of the people that I loved in my life, they just really didn't know how to vibe with me anymore. And beautiful, amazing people that I hung out with all the time, now I just never talk to. And it's not because I don't deeply love them and not that they don't love me. It's just that we just are living so differently. You know?
Exactly. And I think the things that brought you together sometimes is alcohol.
Trauma.
And the trauma, yes. And the wanting to share it and then numb it together, like with booze. And I think that a big part of the process in giving up alcohol, and I want to hear you speak on this, Amy, definitely, is discovering who you are and what's true for you. And then you really know who isn't, you're not vibing with anymore, because what's true for them is so different than it is for you. And sometimes that social salve, you know, as you referred to alcohol, it's not allowing those engagements to be as easy and flowy.
If I could put on my like previous frequent drinker hat too, like when someone decides to quit drinking, like I was the exact person who was saying all the things I would never want someone to say to me, but just like, oh, this is going to be an environment where I can't have the thing that I am needing or wanting or like my addiction. And so if I'm just going to be sitting the whole time thinking about like, okay, like, well, what are we going to do? And right. I would be, you know, hanging out with a sober person at their house, just anxiously awaiting for the moment where I can leave so that I can go drink. And that's like a crazy, I mean, I don't know how many people would like admit that out loud, especially in the moment. Like, I don't want to hang out with you because it makes me feel itchy because I'm an addict and I want my fix, you know?
Yes.
And we've talked about how we identify, and I don't know if necessarily either Katie or I like identify as alcoholics, but at least that's how I felt at the time. So I don't know. However you define that is whatever. But
yeah, I think that with gray area drinking and how normalized it is to drink in social settings from the time that you're able to have independent relationships with people outside of your home. So of course, while I was drinking and one of my friends stopped drinking, we saw each other less because I didn't know what was socially acceptable at that time outside of drinking. That wasn't modeled for me.
Right.
Yeah. And I guess thinking more on having that and knowing that I would be the only one doing it if everyone else wasn't drinking made me uncomfortable. So it was harder to want to put myself in those situations, I think.
I wish that... I'm like looking back and I'm like kind of, I don't know why I'm just cringing because I remember my poor mother, but I remember I'd be like, oh, I'm going to my parents' house, I'm bringing a six pack. Just kind of going to my mom's house, grabbing a bottle of wine. And my mom's like, you're drinking again? And it's like, yeah.
I used to, like I said, my dad's sober, but he's my parent who lives here in the state of Oregon. My mom lives in Michigan and she doesn't drink, never really has. But I used to drink two IPAs here at the house before I would go to my dad's. and he doesn't drink, but I was just like, I'm not fucking doing this sober. Like, there's no way. I have to get this buzz on before I go there. I just am not, this is not going to happen. And then I would lie about it, right? Like, he wouldn't ask me, but I'd be like, mints in my mouth and, you know, like, how can I exist in this space without putting on this mask, because I need a buzz to be able to handle this situation.
Yeah. I remember many times going to like my brother's house or a friend's house, and I'd bring my own alcohol because I'm like, you're not drinking, that's cool, I'm going to be. And it was just like bringing my own snacks so that everybody feels happy that I brought them snacks. And then this is my wine. And then if you change your mind, here's like all the options that I also brought for you.
Mm-hmm.
And it was like, this is what I'm doing while I'm here. And I think that in and of itself, it was just kind of like, well, this is how I'm showing up, so take it or leave it. But if you want me here, this is what it takes. Because I had to feel like, and I think to Kaylee's point, I had to feel comfortable. So I couldn't feel comfortable unless I was drinking. And that had so much more to do with just like, I don't know if you've had this experience, Kaylee. I'm curious because of the comment that you made, because it's something that I've experienced, but sometimes I'm like, well, I don't want to go. And I'm like, wait a minute, it's this networking event, it's this thing for work, I have to go. And then I'm like, do I have to go? Am I going to miss out on curating these relationships? Am I going to be behind and like, you know, the friend thermometer or whatever, if I don't go to this party or this thing? Or could I do something like one-to-one with this person? Do I just get uncomfortable in big groups of people that I don't know, which sounds fine.
Yeah.
If you just say that, right?
Yeah.
But I don't know if you've had that experience where you're just like, I think it's okay that I don't like going to these things. And how many other people maybe would have that, you know, conversation with themselves if they weren't getting toasted before they went somewhere?
Dude, yeah. I mean, it's just crazy how much more reflection we're able to do and understand ourselves, right? And like you said, like get to actually know myself and who I am and what I like, and then be proud of myself on top of that for like, oh, I'm actually kind of a cool person. And yeah, it is okay that I get really overstimulated, like loud music, if TVs are going on, I have a really hard time focusing and like paying attention to what someone's saying. And so I've found that like, three other people and me is kind of the max of what feels good to be able to make sure I'm like having friends that are comfortable with breaking off and having little smaller conversations and things like that. Just because I also want to get deep and I want to talk, you know, more in detail about what's going on with the people that I care about. And it's just hard in an environment that's like really loud and like a sports bar to be able to have those conversations. And it just, yeah, it stresses me out. So it does, I do still struggle with like FOMO and wanting to like be out and about and I don't know, have adventure and have new exciting experiences in my life. But I say no to a lot of stuff because yeah, the types of things I want to do are different. And I've been able to identify that as a result of being alcohol free. So I definitely can relate to that feeling.
It's interesting, like, especially in the line of work that I'm in charge of curating relationships so that we can further the mission of the organization. That's my job. And then I have to manage these employees so that they feel like they're on track in their roles, that they're achieving the goals that they have. And so I have 8 direct reports, and then I'm working right now on 30 donor relationships a week, different ones.
Damn, that sounds like just emotionally exhausting.
Right. It can be. And so something that I had to really start to focus in on was instead of time management was energy management, because it was like, all right, what meetings are really sucking the life out of me? When I'm leaving the meeting with this person or this type of meeting, I'm not okay. So I want to make sure that I have meetings set up right after that one or right before that one or both. They really fill me up so that I can be okay leaving that. Because then it becomes, how do I curate a space where my sobriety is protected, right? That it's not like at risk at all, because I'm protecting me. And it was, I don't know if you two have tried this, but I started even thinking about myself, like my body as a separate person that I take care of. And it was really helpful for me. It's like, all right, I need to be doing all these things. I'm going to be, you know, awake from this time to this time. So I need to make sure that my body is cared for, you know, that I'm connecting with her, that she feels like she's safe. So what are the things and the positions that I can put her in so that she feels all of these things and can accomplish the goals that she has? And that's really helped my sobriety a lot, because I think that I just never really acknowledged myself as somebody to be deeply loved and seen. And it was always like, how can I fit in to what other people's expectations are of me, mm-hmm. or what other people need from me instead of who I am?
Yeah, I can really relate to that. Thank you for sharing that.
Yeah, that's so powerful. I was going to say too, it's interesting because you're doing these things to protect your sobriety, and also your sobriety is protecting yourself and fulfilling those needs. So it's like this mutual relationship. And I think that that's huge. I'm so glad that you said that. I love that, you know, energy management versus time management. I wrote that down because I'm going to lean into that one. Some things fill us up and some things don't. So I like that sandwiching idea as well. That's awesome.
I've definitely not perfected it, and I definitely did not coin that, but it's been helping me a lot. It's been helping me a lot. And I, at least for me, I think that I always have struggled with this idea of not being enough. Mm-hmm. And I think that that came from a lot of different things. I was like, yeah, it just came from a lot of different things. And as an adult, I read this quote that I really liked, and I'm going to mess it up, but it essentially says, our greatest fear is not that we're inadequate. Our greatest fear is that we're powerful beyond measure. Mm-hmm. It's not our darkness, but our light that's most frightening to us. And so then it goes on to talk about, like, who are you to think that you're not worthy, that you're not powerful, that you're not amazing? And I started wondering, like, what if I thought that I was good? And what if I thought that I was worthy and that I belonged? What would that look like? And somebody told me one time, they were like, you know, if you were unlike 99% of people in the world, there would still be 75 million people that are exactly like you.
Oh, that's so comforting. I love that stat.
Yeah, that's a good one.
And so just like really starting to understand the fullness of what society is selling us as true, which is like, if you really start to just stop and think about it, we've all just kind of like bought into this weird matrix.
Yeah, 100%.
It's like we're all spinning on a rock in the middle of space, just kind of like figuring out what we've decided to be okay before we die. So that's cool. Mm-hmm. But if we really stop and we're like, all right, I get this one beautiful life, right? And then it's done. So do I want to be spending my life being confused about who I am and numbing who I am? Or do I want to pause that and really just step into the depth of the pain and figure it out so that I can at least say that I tried?
Yeah.
And maybe see what's on the other side of that. And it honestly, for me, it's been so hard. It's been so hard. And it's been right. I'm not even going to say it's been like happy and like, you know, whatever, or fulfilling or whole or whatever. Like, because that's, I don't even understand what that means, to be honest.
And it implies that you weren't before, right?
Right.
I think that there's something so beautiful about, you said, the deepness of the pain, because there's so much range. And the more that you can feel the bad, right? The ugly, the despair, it just opens up this whole other side of the joy and the fullness of the human experience. Mm-hmm. We can't just have one side of it. It's all of it.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And I know that that's what I was missing out on when I was drinking, was the range, was the fullness of what I'm capable of.
I also took from that, like, what would, like, the light being the most scary part. And like, yeah, well, because that's vulnerable. Like if I know that I suck and that's my identity or whatever, negative things I say about myself, then when those things like prove themselves to be true, then it's not a surprise. That's like safety. That's comfort zone.
Mm. Yeah.
Is being in depression, is being in self-doubt and all of those things. But like to really let go of that and put yourself out there and live your best, like most authentic self and show that and show your gifts to the world, that's scary because that's you showing up saying, I feel good about this and I'm confident and I'm powerful and here's what I have to say and I think you should listen. And that's terrifying. Mm-hmm. And that's something that I'm working through with, you know, even doubts about the podcast and things I say and how I show up here to just everything, every aspect of my life is like, oh, I'm finding that I know that I've struggled with self-confidence my whole life and low self-esteem and depression and anxiety and all of those right. things. But I actually don't want to break those patterns because I'm afraid and I'm scared. And so how do I get to that? And I think even getting to unearth those layers to it
right.
has only been possible because of being alcohol free.
Mm. Yes.
My first step would have just been to like, I don't like myself. And then I'm like, oh, that doesn't feel good. And then I drink about it and then nothing changes. There's like no unearthing of how to get to like the meat of actually solving that problem, if that makes sense.
Right. No, it totally makes sense. You know, I've been working with sex workers and sex trafficking survivors for a while now. And the amount of like secondary trauma that I come into contact with, it's a lot. Mm-hmm. And I honestly, like, I'm just such an empath. Like, I was trying to explain to my counselor one time, you know, I'll walk past somebody on the street and if they're crying and I don't stop and connect with them in some way, first of all, I notice that somebody's crying, mm-hmm. right? Like, mm-hmm. which is most people don't. And people are like, what? No, that's not totally happened. But I'll think about that person the rest of the day and then just feel this deep-seated guilt, which is something that I'm working through. And I realized, like, first of all, I'm not responsible for everybody, yeah. right? Which being alcohol-free has helped me with. Mm-hmm. And second of all was, whoever told me that I was responsible for everybody is wrong. Mm. I can choose to do community care, whatever it is, but that's not why I'm here. Mm-hmm. And then that's okay. But it was interesting because earlier on, I would say all the time, I mean, this was my line. I'd be like, all right, I need a brain break. I just need a break from thinking and feeling and all these things. And so I would just drink because mm-hmm. it would give my brain a break. Mm-hmm. And I have, gosh, a slew of things. I have a panic disorder, which essentially means I get multiple panic attacks a day for apparently no reason. And then I have anxiety, intense anxiety, and then depressive disorder. And honestly, it just ends up coming from unchecked empathy is, you know, from being a kid. Mm-hmm. But what was interesting is like all of these feelings and all of these things, they were just so easily quieted with alcohol. And then the next day would happen and then I would just quiet them again. And then the next day would happen and quiet them again. And it just became a more comfortable pattern mm-hmm. because I became like more comfortable managing the trauma and managing the emotions and quieting them than I did like confronting the trauma. But that's what I mean. Like it didn't make me happy when mm-hmm. I was confronting the trauma. In fact, it was paralyzing.
Yeah.
Not drinking was paralyzing. It was terrifying. It was so scary. Mm-hmm. Like I didn't even know who I was or like how to think or how to behave. Like you're talking about like, where do I, you know, what parties do I go to? And people always talk about like sobriety is like, it was amazing. It's so freeing. It's terrifying. And that's okay. Mm-hmm. Like, mm-hmm. okay.
Yeah. We talk about in sobriety, how we're just like raw dogging our emotions is what we call it. Like we're not using anything to soften these blows that we're experiencing. And then we have this like ultimate level of accountability that then tend for our needs.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And that accountability is scary.
Right.
You know, and I remember at multiple points, even when we started recording the podcast, because I had been, I think like 8 months alcohol free when we started recording. And I just had a year and 9 months at the beginning of September But I remember recording a couple times and beforehand and even on the pod telling Kaylee, like, I'm just mad. I'm angry. I don't feel good. I don't want to do this.
Right.
I don't know who I am. I don't know if I'm likable. I don't. Right. And I didn't feel lovable at that time.
Right.
And those were skills that I had to like learn how to flex and like grow those muscles over time to believe that about myself. It's a process for sure. And there's so many great things, but there is equally amount of terrifying things involved. Amy, I was going to ask you, did you have a diagnosis or were you, if you feel comfortable sharing this, were you taking medication while you were drinking for your mental health?
Yeah.
Same girl.
Yeah. Okay. We like to kind of talk about SSRIs and yeah, that's not my experience, but I know that a lot of our listeners have this, you know, there's this duality in mental health and alcohol abuse and et cetera. So I'd love to hear your take on that or your experience with that.
Yeah. I remember actually at one point my counselor, she was like, so you're still having about a bottle of wine a night? And I was like, yeah. And she's like, and you're positive the Lexapro is working? I was like, oh yeah, I love Lexapro. I love it. Lexapro is totally working. And she was like, and how many Xanax are you taking? And it was just like, why? What's wrong? But even then, I think like I've always understood myself to have like addictive tendencies. And so I remember super early on with Xanax, I was like, I need to get off Xanax. Because it was like, I don't know if either of you have ever tried Xanax, but it was messing with my memory.
That's not one that I've had the pleasure of dabbling with. I'm on Wellbutrin and I was on Bupropion. Is that the same thing? Yeah, that's the same thing. I was on something else, Buspar, for a little while. So in the same like genre of anti-anxiety medications, but Xanax not one that I've tried. But it was affecting you were like forgetting things.
Mm-hmm.
Is it short term or?
I mean, everything term. Yeah. At one point I was like, why is the oat milk in the pantry again? And then how are my keys in the freezer? Like, what is happening? And then I just got kind of freaked out. And so I was like, I went to my doctor and I was like, could Xanax cause memory problems? And they said yes. And so I was like, cool, let's taper off this, please. Thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah, totally.
But yeah, definitely was drinking while taking Lexapro, while going to my counselor 3 times a week. And honestly, like it really took my grandma dying and me drinking way too much the night of her funeral. And my brothers, they were just like, you can't drive. What are you doing? And I just was like ticked. Honestly, I was mad at them.
Mm-hmm.
I was mad because I thought that they were embarrassing me.
Mm-hmm.
And then once I sobered up a little bit, I was like, all right, we need to make some changes.
Yeah. Especially while you're holding space for all that grief and like trying to navigate the loss of someone that you love.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, I think like drinking and taking medication, that's something that people make jokes about all the time. And it actually really hurts your brain. Mm-hmm. It really hurts your brain. It scares me a little bit. The more that I have learned and have friends that are doctors now and I'm like, oh, bummer, little Amy, I wish you would have known. I could have been like an engineer just kidding.
Well, I don't know, but you are the executive director of the Cupcake Girls, so I think that you're fucking doing a great job. I think that's an amazing title to have. I was going to say too, and this is more of an ask, but do you feel like it was addressed with you that there should be no alcohol consumption while you're taking medication for anxiety and or depression?
No, I think that like, it was suggested, but I got more of a warning from the bottle, the prescription bottle than I did from my doctor. I don't think that was like anything malicious or intentional. I just think that
it's just there's not a lot of like informed consent when you enter a relationship sometimes with medication, and then what you're doing recreationally, it's not maybe being imparted as firmly as it should be. There should be some education around that and how it can affect you.
Maybe it's curse of knowledge too. And honestly, maybe somebody did try to explain it to me and I just didn't really hear it because I was just not okay.
Yeah, definitely. There's so many factors that go into it.
I had an excellent doctor though. And I remember even before she put me on, this last time when she put me on medication, she was like, all right, let's try all these supplements. Let's do all these things. Let's shock your adrenal gland. Let's get all this going. And I've continued taking the supplements just because they're amazing. But she worked really, really hard to set me up for success. And I was just like not having it. I was just like clawing on for dear life to everything that was more comfortable for me. Mm-hmm. But to be frank, at that time I was working 3 jobs and raising Lux. So it was a little too much, right?
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. There's only so much you can do. I remember doing kind of a similar thing with a naturopath and trying to figure out like what was going on with my stomach issues and them telling me like, here's all these things you should be taking and here's all these lifestyle changes you should be making. And I was like, absolutely not. Like, I'm so glad I gave my time and my money and my investment into all of these blood tests and panels and all of this stuff. But if the result is to like not eat gluten, then I'm not following this advice.
I'm fucking out.
And like stop drinking. Yeah, no, absolutely not.
Yeah,
I know. The doctor told me years and years ago, back in like 2007, I'm not allergic to gluten or have a gluten intolerance. I'm actually allergic to wheat. Mm-hmm. And I like break out in hives and like my throat gets really scratchy. And so I just started learning that if I popped Benadryl, it was fine. And I could just keep eating bread because I just love bread. I mean, I'm one of those people who, when I was pregnant, I sat down with a loaf of French bread and I just like eat it. It was so good. It was perfect for me. And now my doctor's like, you know, if you continue doing that, you're going to get Crohn's.
Oh, shit.
Like,
damn,
you have to stop. And I'm like, okay. I just think like we're just kind of like front of mind creatures. We don't have a lot of foresight. It's important to have foresight to be thinking about that, which I think sobriety helps with.
Yeah. It does. I think age does too. Just as we get older and we understand that we're not invincible. And as we get older and we see people that we love that we, you know, unfortunately have to say goodbye to and or see the way that their health is affecting them. I had a boss at a restaurant I worked at where I felt a lot of pressure to drink when I was there, specifically by him. I quit in 2000 and the summer of 2017. And he passed away 2 years later of alcoholism at 43.
Wow.
He passed away, I think, 2 months after I quit drinking.
Wow.
And I was like, if that isn't a sign that I'm doing the best thing for me, I don't know what is. It was really,
right.
It's very real when you're confronted with those kinds of wake up calls.
Yeah.
So, and I wanted to ask too, how has quitting drinking affected your relationship as a mom that does everything, you know, that works full time and is, you know, raising Lux? What does that look like for you?
Yeah, it's been interesting. I think I didn't realize how scared I was to be a mom. Lux is light. I mean, Lux is amazing. And Lux is also an extrovert. Mm-hmm. And I am an introvert. And Lux wants a lot from me at all times. I mean, we're talking about going to those big group networking events. She thrives in big groups and she wants to be in big groups and she wants to go out all the time and hang out with all the people and sing and dance and have everyone know her name. And I'm like, all right, I just did that at work all week and I'd like to stay home this weekend and just curl up in bed and snuggle and we can like watch Disney Plus, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so it was an adjustment for us because I didn't feel very fun.
Mm.
And she didn't feel like I was engaging because I was more quiet and honestly dealing with a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
But I think truly her and I have right now, the relationship that I'm hoping to build is just like so much in my sites now. It's like, I just keep getting closer and closer to that. I think we listen to each other and we deeply respect each other and want to know about each other and learn about each other and understand that the other person may not have the same capacity. And we have really beautiful conversations about our emotions and how we're feeling. And yeah, I think it changed everything because it changed everything in me. I think that it created a lot of safety for my little Virgo.
Yeah.
Who likes everything planned out. Mm-hmm. And she'll tell people too. We'll be out and she's like, my mom doesn't drink. They'll be like, what would you like to order? She's like, my mom takes it virgin. She's so funny.
Yes,
but it's been interesting because I don't know, like that feeling of needing to get like, revved up before you go to a networking event. I'll have a coffee before I pick her up from school because I know that I need to be ready for the emotional download that is my 8-year-old wanting to talk about, you know, this friend did this and this is how she's feeling about this. And I want to be available for that. And I don't want to miss that. And also I'm an introvert. And so understanding that has been helpful, but not having that 9 o'clock, it was a learning curve for both of us. Mm-hmm. Because usually like I'd have wine, she'd listen to music. We'd be like dancing and singing. And it was, so it was a big, like a, we're still dancing and singing and all of that. But it's different. It looks different. And it's become healthy and more manageable. And I remember things, honestly. Also, I think that like sobriety has really taught me how to build up community support and ask for help with raising Lux. And I always, even before I was sober, I would always lean on community because more so out of necessity. We live in Las Vegas now, but when we were living in Portland a year ago, all my brothers were pretty close by and I had a really tight knit friend group. And so I would get help with watching her when needed, but I would also get help with, you know, me feeling a little bit lower one day or one weekend and getting someone else to hang out with her so that I could be low and that be okay. And so moving to Las Vegas, we lost that community in Portland. And I had to really learn how to build that from scratch here, being a sober person. And it's been really beautiful. It's been really beautiful to watch how people are excited to come alongside you and help as you're raising somebody and pour into them and all of that. But yeah, I'd say that how sobriety affected my parenting and how sobriety affected my relationship with Lux is like, it affected everything, really changed my thought process. And her experience for sure gave her a safer parent.
Yeah. That's so awesome. That.
Yeah.
Not that I was ever like physically unsafe, but just like, I mean, like emotional safety as I'm becoming more healthy, then of course she has like a safer environment.
Yeah. Well, and you learned how to create safety for yourself. And so that's the first step in that.
I have a follow-up question. We were talking about community and, you know, moving to a new place and, you know, being alcohol-free and being a mom. I know sometimes relationships just kind of like pop out of the woodwork and there's like beautiful synchronicity and how things, how you get linked up with other people. But do you have any advice if someone was like moving or kind of in a place where they weren't around their usual friends and family, how to navigate that, especially like as an introvert? Because that is definitely a challenge. And I'm sure a lot of people can relate to that and have been wanting to know how to navigate that.
My biggest piece of advice for people moving to new cities is volunteer. Seriously, find a cause that you care about or one that you are like kind of caring about, but volunteer. I think that that's like always the best way to get involved in the community and meet really cool people, like-minded people who care about either the environment or animals or whatever it is. I think that it's a really cool way to build friendships. Another thing that Lux and I did in Portland and do here is we joined a walking group.
Nice. I love your posts about that.
Yeah, we love it so much. And so finding like something that you can do that stimulates you mentally, but also something that stimulates you physically. I'm not a runner. I used to be a runner. Oh my gosh. Do you remember I used to run like 5 miles a day? Like, what was that? I don't know. Who was that person? But
who was that person?
I don't know who she was, but Lex and I will walk and then everybody else runs or jogs. And it's just a nice way to build community is just figuring out, okay, how do I get on the same wavelength with these people mentally and, you know, physically? And yeah, that's been super helpful for me. Because that is true where you just used to like go to the neighborhood bar. The dive bars were like my favorite thing ever. And I just go and make friends. And since that's not a thing, and Vegas is a really transient town too. So there's a lot of folks that are coming here to visit, but they're not coming here to live. Mm. It's kind of like a little island because you have all of the surrounding desert and it's just kind of this big city in the middle of the desert. And so there's not a ton of community anyway. Mm-hmm. And I think that people really work hard to try and figure out how to make it, but there's actually a large sober community in Vegas, which has been really nice. There's like this, really cool nonprofit that all they do is sober events. So they'll do rock climbing and kayaking and yoga and all this stuff. And they have a different event every day of the week. And as long as you've been sober for 24 hours, you can go to these events for free. And so that's really cool.
That's so cool.
Yeah, that's what I would say. I think like some people, AA is their thing or a Celebrate Recovery or whatever it is. And definitely AA like had its place for me for a really long time. But for some reason that stopped being my thing. And I don't really know why, but it did. I think the evenings was hard and trying to figure out time with like Lux and work and all of that. But, but I would say like, yeah, volunteering, walking groups, running groups.
I love that because I wouldn't have thought about volunteering, which means I should probably fucking volunteer. I would love to. And I wrote that down on my list from this conversation. So thank you for sharing that. There are a lot more opportunities, I think, than what we realize.
Yeah. And I think it's really important. You know, when I was growing up, my parents would always say, if you're in the community, you should be giving back to the community. Mm-hmm. And so that's kind of a mentality that I've always had. And even when I was a flight attendant, we'd have overnights and I'd look for the local like soup kitchens or whatever it was and just try and make friends that way. And I have lifelong friends from those experiences. Mm. Yeah, Kaylee knows. The first thing when she moved to Portland, I was like, all right, where can we have you volunteer? Probably Cupcake Girls.
Yeah, and I did. And I still like follow people from doing that on Instagram and hype each other up. And it's awesome.
That's cute. I love that.
And I feel like that's such a good segue too, because I want to hear about the Cupcake Girls on this call. And you started out volunteering for them.
Yes. So back in when I was a early teen, one of my friends, trigger warning, sexual abuse, but one of my friends was being abused by two police officers in our town in Eugene, Oregon, and told me about it. And she's a sex worker. And I didn't really understand the different privileges that I held as somebody who was not a sex worker until really hearing about this experience. And she built up enough self-determination and self-empowerment to talk about what was happening to her. And then a dozen other people came forward and said that the same thing was happening to them. All of them were either sex workers or sex trafficking survivors. And they ended up prosecuting the two officers and they're, you know, in prison. And, but it was really just like this big moment for me of, first of all, I thought that I could trust the police and I can't trust all police. And then also, you know, this experience in life is so different from my friend than it is for me. And then when I was a flight attendant, I saw trafficking on the planes as well. And that was before they had like the placards in the airports and things. And so when you saw something, you were put through this training on what to do and who to connect folks to. And so we did that. But it was when I moved to Portland, Oregon in 2009 that I went on a run with my dog, running with my dog. I believe I used to run. And I saw a woman being abused on the side of the road. And I ran to the local Safeway to have the security guard call 911 because I didn't have my cell phone on me. And he looked out the window at who was being hurt and laughed. And he's like, she's a prostitute. They're just going to arrest her anyway. And I ended up running upstairs to my apartment, grabbing my cell phone, calling 911. And by the time that the officers came, the woman was gone.
It's so frustrating.
Yes. And I asked the officers, like, is it true? Would this person have been arrested? And this is before safe harbor laws were introduced in Oregon. And they were like, yeah, you know, this person is pretty well known as a sex worker in this area. And so I didn't know very much about the police department. And I was like, I want to talk to your manager. Mm-hmm. And so they had me talk to like their supervisors. And I ended up sitting across the way from the chief of police, who is Chief Rosie at the time. And she told me that if I wanted to make any change in the world, I needed to get involved with grassroots nonprofits or work to change legislation. So I've dedicated my life to doing both. And then from there, I really started getting involved with anti-trafficking orgs and became really apparent that there was a lot of money being raised for awareness of anti-trafficking work. But there wasn't a really clear understanding of where the money was going. Mm-hmm. And I was really frustrated by that. And I was also really frustrated by the lack of resources that folks were getting from these organizations. People that were, the money that was getting raised in the orgs, that it was getting sent to like far off countries or like different states. And I was like, but there's issues happening here. I don't understand. And then the Cupcake Girls had started in Las Vegas in February 2011. And then a client moved to Portland, Oregon in November 2011 and said, we need to do Cupcake Girls here. And then I started with the Cupcake Girls in February of 2012. Mm. So I kind of started right when Cupcake Girls was taking off. But essentially, it was such a phenomenal experience and has been a phenomenal experience for me because I was able to really help build the organization from what it was to what it is today. And so right now what it is an organization that provides wraparound care for folks who are consensual sex workers. So people that are choosing to work in sex work, and Cupcake Girls understands sex work is a job like any other job. Sometimes you love your job. Sometimes you hate your job. Sometimes you're looking for another job, but you're doing your job. It's a job. And we'll provide resources to folks who are doing sex work, as well as people that are being forced, coerced, or manipulated into sex trafficking experiences. And how we do that is reach out into the community. So we'll work with doctors, dentists, lawyers, auto mechanics, daycare providers, and we'll ask them, would you be willing to give your services at a discounted or pro bono rate? And then they say yes, and we turn around and provide the services to our clients. Mm. And it's been really cool because we don't have any strings attached. So there's no agenda, whether it's like religious or otherwise. We're not saying you have to follow this specific plan. You can only work with us if you're getting out of the industry, because we are understanding that sex work is work. If somebody comes to us and they're saying, you know, I want to figure out how to get my kids back, I'm not wanting to leave sex work, then we figure out how to help them achieve that goal and their timing. And if somebody's trying to leave their trafficker, then we help them with that as well. But it's amazing, amazing work. I'm super pumped. I'm going to be celebrating 11 years in February, which is wild.
That's so amazing. Cool.
Can't even believe that like I can be celebrating anything for 11
yeah,
years.
Yeah, I know. Sometimes so I'm like, am I 11? What? How yeah. did that happen?
Yeah.
I think I am. We are. We're 11. It's fine.
We're 11. That is so cool. Amy, where can any of our listeners find you on social media or learn more about the Cupcake Girls and their mission?
Yeah, so we're always looking for monthly donors. And so if you have $5 extra that you're willing to give up, you know, give up that one latte a month, please go to www.thecupcakegirls.org and become a monthly donor. We'd love, love, love to have you. You can always find us on Instagram, TikTok, Twitter. The handle is cupcakegirls.org. And yeah, that's where you can find us.
Yeah, I'm so excited about this episode. Amy, thank you for talking with us.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Of course, want to let you have any final words, if there's any words of wisdom or takeaways or just things that you were like, wait, I didn't get to talk about this and I want to. Want to make sure you have the space for that as well.
Just that you're important and you matter, and don't give up on yourself. Please don't give up on you. You're important and you matter.